Detroit, its name conjures up images of assembly lines and muscle cars, Aretha Franklin and Marvin Gaye, Stroh's Beer and the Tigers. But other scenes also come to mind. National Guard tanks rolling down Woodward Avenue in the summer of 1967, orange flames against the sky and on Devil's Night, and urban decay, street after street of abandoned houses and factories. And then more recently, urban planners, artists, agriculturalists, and environmentalists who are flocking to Detroit because they see it as an urban laboratory, a place with nothing to lose. Mark Benelli, a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine and Men's Journal, grew up in the Detroit area, moved back to the Motor City 3 years ago, and he's chronicled his experiences in Detroit. City is the place to be, the afterlife of an American metropolis. It's published by Metropolitan Books, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Mark Benelli to our show today. Hello.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Did you move back to Detroit with this book in mind?
Yes. I mean, I went back originally in 2009, January 2009, to cover the auto show that year for Rolling Stone. If you probably remember, that was a very dire time for the auto industry. The Chrysler and General Motors were about 2 or 3 months from bankruptcy. The mayor was in jail. And Detroit had basically become the poster city of the recession. So I saw journalists coming from all over the country, all over the world, really, to sort of cover this story. And I felt like as a native, I could bring more nuance.
Well, did you grow up within the city or in the suburbs?
Just outside of the city. So 8 Mile, people know, is famously the dividing line between city and suburbs. I grew up around 8.5 Mile.
And what kind of work did your parents do?
My parents are both Italian immigrants. My father was a knife sharpener, actually. So he had a shop in the city. And, so I would spend a lot of time in the city as a kid making deliveries for him. So I was there quite a bit.
So this was still a time when Detroit was doing well.
When they came, yes. I mean, it was the boom, the second boom happened during World War II when Detroit, the factories were sort of retooled as tank and aircraft factories, and Detroit became the arsenal of democracy. And post-war, Detroit was kind of doing gangbusters.
And Detroit had always been a destination for immigrants because there were always jobs there.
Yeah, I mean, starting really, Henry Ford, when he realized he needed a more stable, more skilled workforce and instituted the $5 workday, that really created this, immigration from the American South and from all over the world.
And even now, Michigan attracts people you might not expect. There's a very large Muslim population.
That is the one. I mean, Michigan's been sort of steadily losing residents. Across all demographic lines over the last decade or so, it's been hit so hard by particularly the manufacturing loss. But the one demographic that has been growing has been Iraqi immigrants. Yeah.
How did the city deal with that influx of people before and after World War II?
It was tricky. Detroit's always had a history of sort of racial and ethnic tensions. I mean, people know about the 1967 riot, but there were several riots before then. That's contributed in a large part to Detroit's problems over the years.
Well, Southern blacks had come up to Detroit because Henry Ford gave them jobs.
Yes, and Southern whites as well. And, so there was definitely always, potential for.
But was it a segregated city?
It's one of the most, it's historically been one of the most segregated cities in the U.S. I mean, especially, once people started leaving the city for the suburbs, that dividing line between city and suburbs was, there was literally a wall built.
And when did that happen?
The wall was in the 60s, I think. I've interviewed somebody in the book who lived, just on the other side of the wall, of a black Detroiter.
Well, there had been the boom during World War II, and the boom continued as Detroit was the dominant auto creator for the world for a long time. Why did we start seeing white flight, as it's called, in the 60s?
Well, it was a common. It even started in the 50s, really. Part of it, I mean, ironically enough, is the auto companies themselves kind of provided the seeds of the undoing of the city by promoting sprawl, and people were paid enough to own their own cars, so they were taking advantage of this new idea of going out to the suburbs and green open spaces. So,
and everybody wanted to own their own home.
Yeah, and Detroit was never the type of city like New York with lots of tenement buildings and people living in high rises. It was always more, I'd say closer to something like LA, where people had a house and a driveway and a yard.
Well, many would tell you that Detroit's decline began with the riots in the summer of 1967, but from what you've been saying, the roots of that occurred earlier.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think most people agree now. The auto companies started leaving the city well before 67. So
why were they leaving the city?
Well, for, you know, the suburbs, I mean, it's that kind of race to the bottom mentality. You know, there's that article in the Times actually just this weekend about the way, different corporations are sort of, basically shake down local municipalities to try to get tax breaks, and they threaten to leave if, you know, they won't get what they want. And, you know, even according to the Times, GM has been the biggest perpetrator of this kind of thing. Back in the 50s, you know, the city itself was crowded. They wanted to expand their factories, and it was cheap. You know, the suburbs were brand new. They didn't have existing infrastructure to pay for, so they could say, you know, come out here, we'll give you super low taxes, no taxes, we'll give you the land. And so that was happening.
And then there were cities like Flint that also depended on the auto industry. Michael Moore has talked about how that city pretty much died after the car companies left. So this was not unique to Detroit, but Detroit was just the biggest city affected?
Yeah. I mean, there are lots of little Detroits, you know, all throughout the Rust Belt, I would say. But Detroit, you know, Detroit was once the fourth largest city in the U.S. I mean, it's really one of the sort of more epic stories, American stories of the 20th century, the rise of Detroit, and then such a, you know, precipitous fall.
Well, how does the population compare now to, let's say, the 60s when the changes started occurring?
The peak was about 2 million in the 50s, I think mid-50s, something like that. Now it's just over 700,000. And, I mean, that's a drop of about 25% just over the last census period. Basically, in 2000, it was about 1 million, and now it's, you know, 700,000 or so.
So what accounts for the decades of neglect that Detroit experienced? Was it that the car companies were moving out? They still maintain their headquarters in Detroit, and I would think that industry was still pretty much booming in Detroit.
They, you know, a lot of the operations were moved out to the suburbs, and the city itself, you know, I think a lot of it comes down to race. I mean, it really was a sort of very toxic us versus them environment that was created. And in the book, I compare it a little bit to Cuban exiles in Miami who are sort of like shaking their fists across the water at the country they had to leave. And I mean, I feel like that was the attitude of white Detroiters in, like, say, the 70s who left the city. They were very bitter about leaving the city, and they blamed African-American residents.
They felt they'd been forced out by...
Yeah, you know, that was that attitude. And there was an attitude, you know, and I don't want to say generalize completely, but that was definitely in the air, like a sort of, you know, wanting Detroit to fail and feeling like the suburbs could sort of exist independently. The city wasn't really needed. It could be left to rot.
Well, what about the major corporations? As I said, they still had their headquarters there. There's still cars being manufactured in Detroit to this day. The Volt is being manufactured.
Yeah, that was a big deal.
So did the car companies and some of the other companies that had thrived over the years, did they do anything to slow down this downward spiral?
Not really. I mean, the car companies actually, you know, sort of pioneered that, the idea of outsourcing and, you know, get that sort of race to the bottom that I was talking about. I mean, Chrysler's headquarters, it used to be in a little city within the city of Detroit called Highland Park. They left for a suburb about 30 miles north called Auburn Hills. So that took this huge tax base out of Highland Park. And, you know, Highland Park is now, like, worse than Detroit proper.
Well, Michigan itself is really suffering. Why hasn't Michigan benefited from the auto industry bailout the way that parts of Ohio have?
Well, it has somewhat. I think the bailout, you know, I mean, the president, I think rightfully, you know, made that a sort of, you know, signature moment of his reelection campaign and pointed to that as an achievement. But I think, you know, it reminded me in lots of ways of the bank bailout. It was taking a huge amount of taxpayer money, using it to bail out these huge multinational corporations, but not demanding that these corporations, you know, give enough of the upside to regular people. And in the case of the auto companies, you know, somebody who's being hired now in a place like Michigan or Ohio, who is very grateful to get one of these jobs, they're making $14 an hour, which is half of what you'd make before the bailout.
Should we have paid attention when Motown Records, which was an African-American-owned company, moved to Los Angeles?
Yeah, I think that was, you know, that was a sort of bellwether moment as well. That was, you know, I think 73, and yeah.
Although Aretha Franklin continues to live in Detroit.
So does Eminem, still in the suburbs too. So yeah, a few people stuck around.
Mark Benelli is the author of a novel, Sacco and Vanzetti Must Die, and a contributing editor at Rolling Stone and Men's Journal. His book that we are discussing, Detroit City is the Place to Be, The Afterlife of an American Metropolis, is published by Metropolitan Books. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Don't forget to check out our show page where you can take a peek inside our studios with guests like Jack Black and Tony Bennett. Find out what David Hyde Pierce has been reading lately, and even get a recipe for bacon fat ginger snaps. It's all on our show page at WNYC.org. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. You can always catch up with our show on Facebook and Twitter.
WNYC receives support from the School of the International Center of Photography, currently accepting applications and hosting an open house Saturday, December 8th, 2 to 4 p.m. for full-time programs. Now on view at ICP, The Rise and Fall of Apartheid, through January 6th. More at icp.org. Freelancers Insurance Company, a social purpose insurance company providing group-rate health plans to members of Freelancers Union. More information is available at freelancersunion.org.
Gather round the green space for a reading of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, starring acclaimed Shakespearean actor Brian Cox as Scrooge and your favorite WNYC and WQXR hosts as everyone else. This original adaptation by Arthur Uhrings features live music as well as sound effects by Fred Newman of A Prairie Home Companion. Two performances Thursday, December 13th at 5 and 7. Tickets at wnyc.org/thegreenspace.
On the next Fresh Air, Irish novelist, essayist, and short story writer Colm Tobin will talk about his novel Brooklyn was about a young Irish emigre to the United States, and it was a bestseller. In his new book, The Testament of Mary, he imagines Mary remembering her son Jesus 20 years after he was crucified. That's today at 2 on WNYC. We're back with Mark Benelli. His book, Detroit City is the Place to Be, The Afterlife of an American Metropolis. It's published by Metropolitan Books. I want to get to the efforts to revive Detroit. But my sense from what you've been saying to me is that Detroit was kind of allowed to fail.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I don't think a city that was 90% white would have been discarded like last year's automobile the way Detroit was. I mean,
well, how important were the political scandals to damaging the city's image?
That's hurt quite a bit. I mean, there's a section in the book where I spent some time with the former mayor, Kwame Kilpatrick, who I went back to Detroit in 2002 to write a magazine profile of him, and it never ended up running, but it was a really interesting time. I mean, at that point, he was the hot young, you know, one of the hot young stars of the Democratic Party. Chris Rock at the time was making a film about where he was going to be playing the first black president. And he was basing his character on Kilpatrick, not on Barack Obama, who then was just sort of an unknown state senator. So, yeah, he was a really, you know, charismatic figure, flashy dresser, brilliant. But even back then, you know, this was before any of the scandals came out, I could see the seeds of his destruction. I mean, we spent a night doing a patrol. It was around Halloween when they set lots of fires. And at the end of the night, it was around midnight. And he called and arranged to have a masseuse go meet him at the mayor's mansion right in front of me. And one of his aides was like, oh, you know, this is a common thing we do at the end of the night. It's not a big deal. And I was like, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. The political corruption has not helped Detroit.
Well, is Dave Bing, the former basketball star, has he straightened things out?
He was elected, I think, sort of because he was the anti-Kilpatrick. You know, he's older. He's kind of a terrible speaker, actually. So I think the idea was, you know, he's not a guy who will like trick us with his silver tongue the way the last guy did. But he's not. You know, I think Detroit right now, it's such a difficult moment. It kind of demands a visionary figure, and he's not that guy.
The city continues to lose population, and buildings are being abandoned more and more.
Yeah, there's something like 70,000 abandoned buildings. The Detroit News did a poll recently, and I think 40% of the Detroiters polled said they wanted to leave the city within the next 4 years. And the number one reason they cited was crime and violence.
But Detroit is not the worst city for crime in the country. I think it's the fourth worst.
It's St.
Louis is higher. I think Washington is higher.
I don't know. I think it's often neck and neck with New Orleans for the top slot. We're up there. The crazy thing about that stuff is just how underfunded the police department is. I spent a night doing a ride along with some police officers, and there was a shooting, and we were racing to the shooting. And they didn't have GPS. I mean, one of the cops was fumbling with like a physical map, and then he eventually pulled out his personal iPhone and used that to find the place.
So how much vacant property exists?
Between 30 and 40 square miles, so that's basically Paris.
It's being called urban prairie.
Yeah, people refer to it as the urban prairie. I grew up, I was living when I moved back near one of these urban prairie neighborhoods, and I would ride my bike around there, and it's really like, these were once densely populated residential blocks, and now you feel like you're in the country. I mean, the grass is up to your knees.
But I would think that would attract bargain hunters. After all, you have a city. It still has some kind of infrastructure. It has sewage and all of those other things. And if I wanted to start a small business, there are people there who are obviously eager for jobs. There's plenty of space. Wouldn't I be moving in?
That would be a good slogan. We still have sewage. Come to Detroit.
But you know what I mean.
No, I know what you mean. I think that is happening.
Paved streets, I mean, all the stuff that we expect from a city.
Yeah. Well, the problem is that actually isn't the case in a lot of the city. I mean, they're really 40% of the streetlights don't work. Half of the schools have closed since 2007. So in many ways, it's sort of like a failed state. But you are right. I mean, there are artists, entrepreneurs, small business people who are taking advantage of that because you can get, especially New Yorkers, go nuts when they hear about how cheap the real estate is there.
In fact, we spoke to somebody who started a business here making artisanal mustard, and then she moved back to Detroit because Brooklyn was a little too expensive for her.
There are some pickle guys, too. I think McClure's Pickles, they're in Brooklyn and Detroit for the same reason.
Well, one development that has gotten a lot of attention is urban farming. You can actually create a full-size farm within Detroit?
Well, they're more like large, some of these blocks, literally there's one house left. So people are taking over these vacant lots that have just, been completely overgrown. And Detroit is kind of a food desert. There's no grocery chains in the city proper. So people are taking this bad thing and turning it into an asset, all this vacant land.
They're just taking over the vacant land.
Sometimes
kind of squatting on it?
Sometimes they do that. Sometimes you can sort of lease it from the city for like a nominal fee until a developer comes along. And then there are larger scale people who want to do real farming.
Although it is usually not a good idea to farm anything that you want to eat within any city because of environmental concerns.
Well, in Detroit,
contamination.
Yeah, and Detroit's especially tricky because there are a lot of factories and industrial concerns there. So, yeah, one of the big players is a guy named John Hance, a hedge fund guy, who I think he's amassed something like 1,500 acres, and he wants to start a tree farm. So that sort of solves that problem.
But he's a bit controversial because he has had connections to Kwame Kirkpatrick?
Not that so much, but it's more because he's, a wealthy business person. He's, white, seen as an outsider, and it's sort of seen as a land grab. I mean, there's a very sort of toxic history of urban renewal plans in Detroit that, have not served Detroiters all that well. So,
well, some people have described Detroit's experiments in post-urbanism as another form of sharecropping. How are issues of race and class being played out again in this new development of the city?
Well, yeah, that's a perfect example. People talk about, this the new farming, large-scale farming initiative is like a sort of plantation model. That's offensive to some people. Likewise, one of the big plans that's being talked of is the idea of shrinking the city, kind of right-sizing, getting people.
The people are saying Detroit has too much space.
Yeah, I mean, this 40 square miles, it's scattered all over the city, right? So the idea is to, get people to move into more densely populated urban cores and then turn the empty land into parks or farms or anything else. But that's, people are resistant to the idea of land grabs and sort of top-down urban renewal plans because of the history of that in the city.
Well, where's the mayor in all of that?
He's pushing for this, this what he's calling a right-sizing plan, but it's been very slow. I mean, I started I moved back to Detroit in 2009. He started having his first meetings that year, and there still has been very, very little progress. There's just no money to do these sorts of things. That's the problem.
Last month, Michiganders voted down a law that allowed the governor to appoint state emergency managers in troubled communities, people who could do things like change pension agreements and sell public assets and renegotiate union contracts. Had there been attempts to do that in Detroit before voters struck the law down?
Yeah, I mean, the school district has been under state control for most of the last 10 years to, it's been a pretty dismal story there. And then lots of, Highland Park, this other city I mentioned that's within Detroit limits, has been under state control. And they haven't been very successful, but it's not clear what will happen now with this law being struck down.
Well, it sounds to me like the future is still bleak for Detroit.
I came away with a cautious sense of optimism. I mean, I see the economy diversifying. I see entrepreneurs moving in. So things like that are happening. But, yeah, there's a lot to overcome.
Mark Benelli will be speaking with Heidi Ewing, who directed the documentary Detropia, and New York Observer book editor Michael Miller, and signing books tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at Powerhouse Arena at 37 Main Street in Dumbo. The book, Detroit City is the Place to Be, The Afterlife of an American Metropolis, is published by Metropolitan Books. And I thank you so much for being on our show today. I suspect that it's not just Detroit, but a number of other cities that are going through similar experiences.
It's true. Thanks for having me.
On tomorrow's show, the creators of a new documentary, The Central Park Five, will be here along with one of the five men who was falsely accused. And then Corey Olson discusses why J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit has become one of the most widely read and best-loved books of the 20th century. Also, Deb Perlman talks about turning her award-winning blog, Smitten Kitchen, into a best-selling cookbook. And we will examine what newspapers were like at the time of the American Revolution. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blake Neshek, Stephen Valentino, Julia Corcoran. Melissa Aikens, the executive producer, and we had help today from Galen Drew, Todd McGovern, contributing producer Virginia Doris. Ryan Naru was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening, and we will see you tomorrow.